There are just certain times when sometimes you need to kind of rewind the clock a little bit and come back to something simple. As I waded through Ecclesiastes 9 over the past week and even thought back through Ecclesiastes 8 that sets it up that I'll summarize for you, my mind kept going back in a weird sort of way to something I read many years ago that probably most of you have read at some time or another. It was originally a poem that ended up becoming the title of a little book. The book was some musings by a man by the name of Robert Foljam. And the title of the poem, and when I say it, you'll know it, "All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten." And as I reflected on that and went and found it and read it, I thought, you know, what a great way to start a sermon that's going to start us out in depression and hopefully bring us out to remember that there are some simple things in life that God gives us in a variety of ways that we need. So listen quickly here. All I really need to know about how to live and what to do and how to be, I learned in kindergarten. Wisdom was not at the top of the graduate school mountain, but there in the sand pile at Sunday school. These are the things I learned. Share everything. Play fair. Don't hit people. Put things back where you found them. Clean up your own mess. Don't take things that aren't yours. Say you're sorry when you hurt somebody. Wash your hands before you eat. Flush. Warm cookies and cold milk are good for you. Live a balanced life. Learn some and think some and draw and paint and sing and dance and play and work every day some. Take a nap every afternoon. When you go out into the world, watch for traffic, hold hands, and stick together. Be aware of wonder. Remember the little seed in the styrofoam cup? The roots go down and the plant goes up and nobody really knows how or why, but we're all like that. Goldfish and hamsters and white mice and even the little seed in the styrofoam cup, they will die. So do we. And then remember the Dick and Jane books? The first word you learned, the biggest word of all, look! Everything you need to know is in there somewhere. The golden rule and love and basic sanitation, ecology and politics, equality and sane living. Take any of those items and extrapolate it into sophisticated adult terms and apply it to your family life or your work or your government or your world, and it holds true and clear and firm. Think what a better world it would be if all, the whole world, had cookies and milk about 3 o'clock every afternoon and then lay down with our blankets for a nap. Or if all governments had a basic policy to always put things back where they found them and to clean up their own mess. And it's still true, no matter how old you are, when you go out in the world, it's best to hold hands and stick together. I think the teacher would have liked that little piece of wisdom, because I think that little piece of wisdom there really resonates with all of us. The teacher in the book of Ecclesiastes is trying to figure out how the world works under the sun. And by and large, most of the time, he sort of pulled God out of the equation. In chapter 8 of Ecclesiastes that I'm just going to summarize because I believe it's the preamble for chapter 9, the teacher begins with a question: who is like the wise? And who knows the explanation of things? And the assumed answer is nobody. Nobody really knows how things work. And he goes on in verses 2 all the way down through verse 8, and he talks about how one should live in relationship to an all-supreme being, a king, They didn't have democracies when the teacher wrote. It was a king who ruled everything. He determined whether you lived or died. And so he gave wisdom on how to live under a king. And yet, at the same time, he's kind of frustrated. Verse 8, he says, as no one has power over the wind to contain it, so no one has power over the time of their death. The teacher realized that life on earth is temporary. Hamsters and goldfish and white mice and the plants in the styrofoam cup die, and so do we. And he realizes that, and it frustrated him. He realized that things aren't fair. We can talk about playing fair and don't hit people and all, but he says in chapter 8, verses 14, there's something else meaningless that occurs on the earth. The righteous who get what the wicked deserve, and the wicked who get what the righteous deserve. And the teacher says, what do I do with all this? How do I handle this? And he concludes that and transitions into chapter 9 with these words at the end of chapter 8, verse 17. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Despite all their efforts to search it out, no one can discover its meaning. Even if the wise claim they know, they cannot really comprehend it. So I reflected on all this, and I concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands. No one knows whether love or hate awaits them. All share a common destiny. The righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. As it is with the good, so with the sinful. As it is with those who take oaths, so with those who are afraid to take them. This is evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. The hearts of people, moreover, are full of evil, and there is madness in their hearts while they live, and afterward they join the dead. I thought long and hard how to say something warm and fuzzy about these first three verses, and it's just not there. No matter who you are destined to one day die. I hate talking about that, and yet it's reality. And you know, we talked last week about sometimes the best place to be, the place where you face reality, the place where you face what's really true about life, is really at the funeral, at the place of mourning, because at that point you are brought face to face with the realities of life. And the teacher says, one day we're all destined, no matter who you are. This whole list, you know, good, wicked, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices, those who do not, everybody has the same destiny. And it's interesting, he says, when I reflected on all this, and I concluded that the righteous and the wise and what they do are in God's hands. He says there's a sense, because the teacher hasn't completely thrown God out of the picture, but he realizes that somehow God's involved, somehow God is there. Everything that we do is somehow in his hands. And yet, he says, no one knows whether love or hate awaits them. I believe what he's saying there is, you can be the most righteous person on the planet, and there are some that are going to despise you no matter what you do. You don't know whether love or hate awaits you. You can be a righteous and wise person, and some people will love you. He says, everybody has the common destiny, so what's the point? And the cynic would say, that's it. There is no point. The cynic would say, live for yourself and live only for yourself. Eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow you die. Some will do something else. They know that death is imminent, so some try to do everything possible to stave off the reality. We're so good about that in our Western culture. There are so many other cultures where the elderly are revered and held in high honor, and we do everything we can to try to stay young. We change our hair. We use wrinkle cream. We take medicine that and we try to exercise, and then we quit exercising because what's the use? But then we go gluten-free, or we do this, or we do that, and we go all down the list, and it's all trying to say, maybe, maybe, just maybe, I can prolong my life a little bit longer. The teacher says, this is madness. There's madness in our heart. The reality is, afterwards, we all die. No matter who you are destined to one day die. This life is not permanent. He goes on, verses 4 and 5 here. Anyone who's among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even their name is forgotten. Their love and their hate, their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. You and I were created to live. I think we should never forget that death is the result of sin. God created us to live. And the teacher says, to be alive, anyone who's among the living still has a sense of hope. To be alive, you have a sense of hope. Hope is not is a word that really could be translated elsewhere, confidence. You see, as long as I'm breathing, I can have a sense of confidence that maybe I can make a difference, that maybe I can do something positive, that maybe I can enjoy the life I have. But when I'm dead, I have no more hope, humanly speaking. And he uses this illustration, even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. Now, when you think dog, when you read that in the Old Testament, don't think of that furry little pooch who's just waiting to greet you at home, you know, who's a good puppy? Who's a good puppy? You know, and the dog in their head is saying, why do you keep asking that? We all know the answer. That's not the kind of dog he's thinking about. He's talking about a street dog. He's talking about a dog that just is a mangy hound that just gets scraps off the street. And he's saying that animal has more hope than a dead lion. Because a lion, the dead lion, all his power, all his might, all his fearsomeness, it's gone. He's dead. And he says there are several realities and benefits to being alive. And the first is, I'm alive, but I know I'm not going to be alive forever. That's not a benefit, but that's a reality. I know that time is short. I know that I have to make the most of it now. He says, the living know they will die, the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, even their name is forgotten. While I'm alive, I have an opportunity, as it were, to build my legacy. When I'm dead, I've got nothing. The dead can't express love anymore. They can't express hate anymore. They have no emotion. The word jealousy there in verse 6, I think that's a very poor translation. I would say their passion has long since vanished. While I'm alive, I can have passion for something. I can have passion for life. I can have passion for people. I can have passion for things. When I'm dead, I've got none of that. While I'm alive, I can express emotion. So what do we do? What do we do in light of this? And I think the point that the teacher makes, he makes it earlier in chapter 8, and he makes it very strongly here, is simply this. Learn to enjoy the life you have right now. My dad used to tell me that he would say to his mom, now, my dad's birth mom died when he was 12 years old. And then his stepmom came into his life, and she was wonderful. She was the grandma that I knew just a little bit. And he would talk about, you know, couldn't wait till this or that, till tomorrow, or can't wait till next Saturday. And he said, she would say, son, you're wishing your life away. Learn to enjoy the life you have now. Look at verse 7. Go eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. The idea is not that God's approval is a carte blanche, but that God has given us His grace to enjoy. Jesus would say in the book of Matthew, the rain falls on the righteous and the unrighteous. We are all under the great umbrella of God's grace. So enjoy the life you have now. When you get together, maybe with friends at lunch today, enjoy that time. Maybe you were with friends over the weekend and you had a gathering. It was a little bit of a party and it was just fun and there was laughter and there was celebration. There is nothing wrong with enjoying that. The Apostle Paul would write in 1 Timothy that God richly gives us all things to enjoy. Enjoy the life you have right now. He says, always be clothed in white and always anoint your head with oil. Those are word pictures of celebrations. In the ancient world, when you went to a celebration, you would be clothed in white. There's a story in the New Testament about people putting on a wedding garment. Everybody came in and they were given a special garment, clothed to show that they were part of the party. To anoint your head with oil sometimes was a healing thing, but it was also kind of cleaning up a bit. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun. All your meaningless days, for this is your lot in life, in your toilsome labor under the sun. Enjoy relationship. At O Dark 30 tomorrow morning, Charlene and I are going to get on a plane and we're flying away. And you know what? I am not going to think about you. Over the next 5 days, the biggest decisions that I want to make are Heinz 57 or A1 on my steak. Those are the biggest decisions I want to make. I am going to enjoy some time away with my wife. We are going to enjoy exploring a part of the country that we've never really explored before. We are going to enjoy waking up in the morning and saying, well, what do you want to do today? I don't know. What do you want to do today? Let's get online and Google what's out there and let's go do it. And we're going to enjoy it. And I know, and God gives us that. Enjoy the life you have right now. And the teacher's putting that forward. And then he says this, verse 10. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the realm of the dead, where you're going, there is neither working nor planning, nor knowledge nor wisdom. Do your best in whatever you do. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Can I say this very clearly for those of us who follow Christ? Whatever job God has given you, do your best. Even if at this moment it feels like a dead-end job, do your best. It's where God has placed you in the moment. Whatever you do, work hard and do it with all your might. I'm in the middle of working on projects for Christmas, and I can't tell you what they are because some of the recipients are sitting here in the room, but one of the ones I worked on for someone at my wife's employment that I finished up yesterday is a cutting board. And man, I worked hard on that thing. I sanded like you wouldn't believe, every grade of sandpaper I can get. Do you know they even make a 36 grade sandpaper? I mean, that's like, that'll take skin off. And I worked and worked and worked. And when I was done and put the final finish on it last night, it shone. It's beautiful. And I think we ought to have that mindset, no matter what God has for us to do, when you work hard and do your best, there is a beauty that comes from that. And the teacher says, as you learn to enjoy the life you have right now, work hard, because there comes a day when you won't be able to work. Now, notice something here. He says,
in the realm of the dead, where you are going, there is neither working nor planning nor knowledge nor wisdom. The teacher didn't have a sense of retirement like we have in the West. You work hard all your life, and when you're done, you move on. You die. And so his idea is, don't just think that I can get by with something. You know, we have this thrust in America. We saw it a couple weeks ago, right? If I just buy the right lottery ticket, then I know you're saying 1 in 3.2 million, but you're saying there's a chance, right? You know, if I just buy the right ticket, I can be wealthy and I can quit work. I don't know how many times I've seen lottery winners say, I went in the next day and I quit my job. And the teachers say, no, work is valuable. Work is good. Work brings us purpose. You know, we try to work as hard as we can and earn as much as we can so we can quit as soon as we can. And the teacher said, no, just work. Be purposeful. That's how you enjoy the life you live right now. You enjoy relationship. You enjoy purpose. The teacher says something else in verse 11. I've seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned, but time and chance happen to them all. Moreover, no one knows when their hour will come. As fish are caught in a cruel net, or birds are taken in a snare, so people are trapped by evil times that fall unexpectedly on them. While we are to enjoy the life we have now, while we are to realize that this life that we have now that we can enjoy is temporary, we also ought to take a step back and look at reality and say sometimes conventional wisdom does not always add up. The teacher gives us 5 very brief scenarios. The fastest person doesn't always win the race. The strongest army doesn't always win the battle. The wisest person may sometimes go hungry. The wealthiest person is not always the smartest person. The most educated person could be passed over. Now, I don't think this is to propound being lazy or foolish. The observation is that those traits, that conventional wisdom, that human wisdom, that earthly wisdom says, those should get you ahead in life. It doesn't always work out that way. The fastest person in the race may, on the turn, twist an ankle and fall down, and they're out of the race. The strongest army may be weakened by a storm. Need I remind you, history books, Spanish Armada, headed up to take over, to invade London, and a storm came through and wiped out half the armada. It may happen. Things happen and they can't be controlled. And we can't control our days. I've told you this before. I will never forget when my mother was told by the doctor that her cancer had returned and that her time was short. And her time was short. It was almost a week later that she passed away. And my mom's response in that moment, where my dad, my sisters, and I were standing there just, you know, waiting to know how she would respond so that we would know how we would respond. And she looked at that doctor, such a wonderful doctor, who, you know, really came up to her, put her hand on her shoulder and on her arm, spoke right to her tenderly. And my mom said, you know, every day ordained for me was written down in God's book. I am ready. Wow, you talk about finishing strong and with dignity. You know, and I remember that because we didn't know. We knew her cancer. She had been 12 years and cancer-free, and all of a sudden it came back. And it was just that reminder, we don't know when our hour will come. That tuna swimming out in the ocean has no thought that they're going to be caught up in that net and be in a can of tuna in your cupboard in the next few months. No idea. That bird flying through the air isn't ready for that net that it gets caught in. And you and I, we don't have a guarantee. We know what we desire, but we don't have a guarantee. So what do we do? When we realize that conventional wisdom doesn't add up, what do we do? How do we respond? And I believe the teacher gives us that response in these last few verses. And it simply is this: we must let godly wisdom be our guide. Verse 13, I saw also under the sun this example of wisdom that greatly impressed me. There was once a small city with only a few people in it, and a powerful king came against it, surrounded it, and built huge siege works against it. Now there lived in that city a man, poor but wise, and he saved the city by his wisdom. But nobody remembered that poor man. So I said, wisdom is better than strength, but the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are no longer heeded. The quiet words of the wise are more to be heeded than the shouts of a ruler of fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. What a great word picture, this small city. A peaceful city, I get the impression of. And all of a sudden, this large, powerful king decided to do a hostile corporate takeover. And he comes with his armies, and they surround the city. They cut off the food supply. They build siege works. They're ready to take over. And this poor man, this man that nobody else in the city regarded, but he was a wise man, he did something. And we're not even told what he did. He may have gone out to negotiate. He may have found a flaw in the enemy's plan. But something he did saved the city. And everybody rejoiced in the saving of the city. But after a while, they forgot about him, because he wasn't somebody who went and made a splash about himself. And the teacher says, the bottom line is the quiet words of the wise are more to be heeded than the shouts of a ruler of fools. Wisdom is better than the weapons of war. The teacher says, true wisdom is the greater strength. True wisdom, though, doesn't brag about itself. True wisdom doesn't clamor to be heard. True wisdom is often quiet. Have you ever known anybody in your life that really reflected true wisdom? As I thought about that, two people came to mind. First guy is Bob. Part of my dad's church in Kansas years ago. Bob was a B-17 Flying Fortress pilot in World War II. Bob ended up being in charge of GMAC financing in the entire state of Kansas. And when Bob came to know Christ, he stepped away from some of that because it was troubling him, some of the things he had to do to make business work. In 1979, my dad, in 1978, he got booted out of a church that he'd been in for 13 years, and we won't go into the details. In that following January, half of the church came and said, would you start another church? And my dad hated that idea. He didn't want to start a competing church, but he ended up starting a church. And as they were beginning to set the church up and the structure of the church up, they decided that they would have a monthly breakfast. Don't rankle at this. I'm just going to tell you the way it was. It was a men's breakfast. The women got to lead from the kitchen table. But it was a monthly breakfast. And they would talk about church business. I got to sit in on some of those meetings. And it was amazing. They would be talking about a decision they needed to make. And everybody would be chiming in. Everybody would be giving their state, their things, what they ought to do and everything. And Bob just sat there. He just sat there. And one of two things would happen. Everybody would kind of be talked out. And either you would hear Bob go, or you would have, or someone would say, Bob, what do you think? He had a low, quiet voice. Well, as I see it, and he would, and every time Bob, it was like the old E.F. Hutton commercials, every time Bob spoke, everybody listened. He had wisdom. He didn't propound, he didn't promote himself, he just had wisdom. And he spoke it when asked, and he did it quietly and kindly and graciously. The other guy I think about is a guy named Roy. Roy was one of the founders of an organization called the American Christian Schools International, ACSI. Roy was part of our church in Indiana, and Roy sat on our elder board for a while. And what I think is not Roy on the elder board, I think at the times when Roy spoke, Roy was big. He was a big old guy. His son had actually got a full-ride scholarship in basketball. And Roy would get up to preach, and he wouldn't move around like I do. He would talk like this. I remember one Sunday his sermon started. He picked up his Bible. Every time I open this word, I feel like the old sea captain who let out the plumb line to log the depth of the water, and they ran out of line, and he logged in deeper yet. And the more that I explore this word that I have studied all my life, I say, deeper yet. And he went on to preach this sermon. And there wasn't a lot of up and down in his voice. It was pretty steady. I was working with teenagers then. Hung out with one of them one day. I said, hey, what do you guys think when Dr. Lowry speaks? Oh, Pastor Scott, he's amazing. It's like listening to your grandpa. I love it. There is so much there. And I thought, wisdom. Those young people saw the wisdom and the depth of that man. Not a big splash, just quiet wisdom. And the teacher says, wisdom is better than strength. And in the ebb and the flow of life, in the ups and the downs and the turmoil around us, you and I need to seek out godly wisdom. And I'm going to suggest to you that godly wisdom is going to be found in the Word of God. And we need to be spending time there. But notice we end, and this is going to set us up, Lord willing, for next week with a sad reality. Just as godly wisdom is so amazing and so great, better than all conventional means of dealing with the problems of our world, yet, he says, a single sinner destroys much good. The ruler of fools can undo so much wisdom. See, people have that tendency. In our heart, we want to be drawn to the quiet, but we tend to be drawn to the dramatic. We tend to be drawn to the big, to the splashy. And we forget sometimes the quiet wisdom of those who may not be the wealthiest, may not be the splashiest, may not be the fastest, but have a view of life that is wise because it comes from a relationship with God. No matter who you are, you're destined to die. Learn then to enjoy the life you have now. Remember that conventional wisdom doesn't always add up. Focus on godly wisdom. Let it be your guide. Ian Provan is a professor of biblical studies at Regent College in Vancouver, Canada. Listen to his summary of this chapter. The God of order, therefore, brings chaos to life so as to remind us that we are not, in fact, gods who control the present or the future. Instead, we are mortals in need of repentance in dust and ashes. Every time a prediction fails, every time the swift do not win the race and the strong a battle, every time our health breaks down or we find our lives poorer rather than richer, or we discover we are miserable rather than happy, every such occasion is a moment of grace and an opportunity to look reality straight in the eye. It is a moment in which we are helped to remember who controls the times. We are dependent. And we have to remember that. And as those who follow Christ, we're reminded that we are dependent upon God. We are dependent upon Him to guide us and to direct us. I can't control anything except my responses. You and I are destined to die, but God has given us today. Let's enjoy today to its fullest. I don't know what your plans are for this afternoon, but I hope you enjoy them, and I hope you relish in them. I don't know what your week is like for this week. I know some of you are hating on me because I'm going on vacation, but that's okay. You know, you can deal with that. But you know what? You're going to have moments to enjoy, moments to relish. Moments at work where you and your coworkers just laugh. Moments at home where you laugh at the children. Moments on Facebook where you enjoy a moment with a friend. Enjoy it. And remember that those times when you can't control, those times when reality hits you in the face, that's a unique grace of God to say, I'm here. He says, I'm in control. Trust me. Follow me. I'll lead you. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word this morning. Thank you for just the reminder in your word this morning that it is truly your wisdom that must be our guide. Lord, as we leave this room, as we spend some time enjoying one another in relationship, as we spend some time enjoying one another over some snacks and some coffee, as we then enjoy one another in the youth room, as we will talk some more about how you created this world and how things can be looked at from a standpoint of seeing your wisdom in so many ways. As we go to lunch today, maybe watch a football game or hang out with friends, in everything we do today, may we enjoy the life that you give us. May we not worry about the temporary nature of it, but know that that is in your hands. And may we trust you and pursue godly wisdom. In Jesus' name.